Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. On the phone line with us this afternoon is somebody who is a quiet but powerful fixture in the world of music and in the world of hip-hop. Her name is Sophia Chang. She just put out a book called The Baddest Bee in the Room. But she's also somebody who we know as a primary figure in the development and the evolution of Wu-Tang, where she managed, you know, RZA, GZA, and ODB. Souls of Mischief have mentioned her in their documentary. She was an A&R, you know, somebody who developed artists for Jive Records. And that's just the beginning. She's done so much. And yet, you know, oftentimes when we talk about powerful people in the industry, you know, her name is just not in the forefront, but it really should be. So she's written a book, and it's one that is being well received. So first of all, Sophie, welcome to the show, and how are you doing?
Thank you so much. I'm doing great. Thank you for that very kind introduction. You said the baddest bee in the room. Am I to assume that I'm not allowed to curse?
Well, you know, I don't mind, but, you know, some of our other folks may be like, why is he using the B word? So we'll keep it PC.
Okay.
But let's start off with that. Why did you name the book with such a provocative title? And I'm asking this in this context, that when we hear that word and the baddest in front of it, we often think of the rap artist Trina out of Miami, who, you know, kind of used that as well. Why use that? Is that a word of empowerment? Is that to make a statement? Or is there something else to that?
I think it's both of those things. What I would ask people to look at when they question the title is that it is a declaration from a 54-year-old Korean-Canadian single mother of two grown teenagers rocking a samurai hairdo. Now, I can see how some people might think it's silly or ridiculous or even offensive, but I think it's radical. I think for me to make a statement like that shatters every preconceived notion that somebody might have about somebody who looks like me, somebody who's middle-aged, somebody who's Asian, somebody who's petite. I think having been born and raised, essentially, and certainly in my adult years, under the specter of the model minority myth, I delight every day in destroying it. So for me, yes, it is absolutely about empowerment. And I can tell you, Davey, the provenance of the term, back in 2008, I believe it was, I was attending the second annual Black Girls Rock Awards. This is an organization founded by DJ model turned philanthropist Beverly Bond. And it is an organization that was created to celebrate the magic of Black girls, as Joan Morgan would say. I happened to be there with Beth Ann Hardison, who was being honored, legendary model herself, model manager, and now fashion activist. Joan Morgan, whom I just mentioned, hip-hop feminist, and to me, the progenitor of modern Black feminism, and Sam Martin, who was an executive at HBO. And as I looked at them, now all of us at that point were 40 and better. And as I looked at them, I thought, wow, my girls are the baddest bees in the room, bar none. And I think what I want to clarify is that this is not competitive. This is not about us walking into a room and doing a survey of every other woman and saying, I'm more this than you, I'm more that than you. It's not, even though it is a superlative. It is not about trying to feel better than everybody else. It's trying to feel better about ourselves in a society and within a culture that doesn't encourage us to celebrate our own beauty, our own power, our own sex appeal, our own creativity, our own ingenuity.
At the same time, Sophie, you know, you also are in a male-dominated rough-and-tumble industry. and that shouldn't go unnoticed and unacknowledged. Well, that means same thing, but in the context of being in an industry that prides itself on being successful by being able to implement the formula of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, the language is very coarse oftentimes. The actions taken by many of its powerful male figures are, you know, beyond coarse. Sometimes they're also, you know, dangerous, demeaning if you're dealing, if you are a woman. So in some ways, is that also a pushback on the type of environment that you've had to navigate and you successfully have done so over the years?
That's an interesting question. Yes, of course, hip-hop, and I would say in particular these days, from what I can gather, so I'm far from an expert on the current music, is, yes, of course, it has been steeped in sexism, and I would say now is actually misogynistic. It isn't so much my statement against hip hop and more broadly the music business. It's really my statement, Davey, against the world. But I will say on the flip side of that, that hip hop and Wu-Tang in particular helped me get to the place where I could claim my own greatness and my own power. They helped me do that. They helped me honor my anger. They helped me find my voice. Wu-Tang introduced me to the beauty of my culture, meaning Asian culture broadly, which I had rejected as a child. So it is certainly not a statement about hip hop. It is a statement more born of what hip hop taught me.
Most definitely. You know, I was very intentional about not using the word hip hop because I think oftentimes hip hop takes on the weight of societal problems. And so I was looking more at the music industry, and maybe, you know, sure, from your understanding of the music industry, let's look at that, because on one hand, hip hop comes in and it disrupts the music industry. And on the other hand, people say it has become the face of the music industry and picking up many of its bad habits. How have you seen the embracing of hip hop, and how have you seen hip hop's trajectory from the late 80s when you got involved to where it is, during your tenure? Did hip hop transform the industry, or did hip hop pick up on aspects of the industry that maybe it should have shed it?
Now, I've never heard it framed that way in terms of the latter. Do I think hip hop shaped the industry? Absolutely, I think it did, and I think it should have. I think that way beyond shaping the industry, I think hip hop shaped global culture. I don't think there is any other musical genre that has had the impact that hip hop has had ever in history. Rock and roll certainly was the first major agitating force in terms of a musical genre. But I think the fact that hip hop has changed the way that we walk, talk, dress, move, dance, and interact. And I mean all over the world. When you talk to the guys in Wu-Tang, and they have toured the world many times over, they will tell you that they can be in the smallest, furthest flung hamlet of whatever little town in the former Soviet Union, wherever it is, in New Zealand or on the continent of Africa or in corners of Europe, and there will be somebody with either a Wu-Tang t-shirt or a Wu-Tang tattoo. Now, that's amazing. So I am proud to say that I was allowed into a community and a culture that has had this incredible shaping. And in terms of the bad habits, I think the fact that it's male-dominated, you go to any industry that is male-dominated and you will find those bad habits. Go to tech. Go to cannabis. Go to any of these places. Frankly, most industries are male-dominated, but the ones that are particularly like have a certain kind of bro-y culture, let's call it. Mm-hmm. And that is testosterone driven. And certainly hip hop by definition from its origins was pretty testosterone driven. I think that I wouldn't say that hip hop picked up on music's bad habits. I think that hip hop probably had plenty of bad habits of its own, but to no degree more than other genres did. I think there's bad behavior, plenty of bad behavior by men against women to go around across every genre, every sector, every industry.
Absolutely. I ask it in this sense because, the brilliance of hip-hop, and I want you to comment on the brilliance or the real positive aspects that you think hip-hop brought to the industry. Oftentimes, hip-hop gets labeled with, oh, it's misogynist. Okay, yeah, but so is rock and roll and everything else around the music industry. It can be combative. Yes, the music industry is built on that. You know, the Clive Davises on down have been combative. But if it's a negative attribute, it often will be weighed. Hip-hop will take the weight and its brilliance and its innovativeness. And it's, you know, as you talked about, the fact that it opened your eyes to your own culture, that story often gets buried. So from your perspective, what are the positive things that you think we should all pay attention that hip-hop brought to the table in terms of transforming the industry?
Well, I think you could just look at RZA asking for a non-exclusive deal for Wu-Tang Clan. I had literally never heard of it before, and I don't think anybody ever got it since. And to the listeners, to explain what that means. When a record company signs a group, they have the exclusive right to release any of the solo members' albums. They're not obligated, but they have the exclusive right to do so. So here comes Wu-Tang Clan, here comes the demo across everybody's desks in 1993, and there are 9 guys, all of them talented. And so RZA says, yeah, you can sign Wu-Tang Clan, and yes, we're going to be huge, but guess what? It's a non-exclusive deal. Now, nobody in the industry could touch that, but Loud did. And I think that was a really smart choice because they knew that Wu-Tang would put them on the map. So that in and of itself, and I think they're probably every group thereafter was asking for a non-exclusive. I mean, RZA completely upset the model, and he set a precedent that, again, I don't know that anybody since then has ever been able to get it. So that's a micro example. In terms of a macro example, what do I think are the positives? I mean, I'll bifurcate in terms of what I think of it creatively and then what I think of it socially and politically. Creatively, I am one of those people that considers hip-hop to be poetry. I think that MCs are poets. Mm-hmm. And I think that it should be considered in the canon of poetry. I think the simple ingenuity of how it was birthed, and I'm not a historian. You'd have to talk to Jeff Chang about this more than me. But just the ingenuity of it being birthed on a corner in the South Bronx, getting plugged into a light post, a lamp post, you know. I think about how the music just was so self-determining and didn't ask permission and didn't ask for validation, but just made the statement that this is who we are and this is what we believe in and this is what we want to say. Is incredible. And all of this, right, we cannot have this conversation about hip-hop without talking about white supremacy, without talking about white fear, without talking about white fragility. I mean, the greatest title, one of the greatest titles ever to me of an album was Fear of a Black Planet. Mm-hmm. Chuck D and Public Enemy and the Bomb Squad, I mean, I think they were prophetic. Public Enemy is one of, to me, the greatest groups of all time. The beats, the rhymes, yes, but also the statements, which then takes me into what I consider to be really important about the political and the social impact that it had. Now, granted, I don't know that Public Enemy would get a record deal today. That's not because they're talented, clearly, but because of the way that the industry has evolved. And I think that if people could do their best to remove whatever preconceived notions they have about rappers, they could look at it for what it is, and it is music. Because you remember, Davey, there was a time when people said that hip-hop wasn't music, and we all thought that was laughable. Oh, it's not music because it's not live instruments? Is that why it's not music? It's not music because the guys aren't singing? Is that why it's not music? I think that you're loath to call it music because you're a... Well, I was about to curse. Because you're a racist. And you're having trouble wrapping your head around the fact that there is this incredibly vibrant, vital, important new art form that is coming, and you will not be able to stand in its way. So if people listen to hip hop, and I'm not saying you have to like it. I don't listen to hip hop like that anymore. I'm 54. I'm not a head like that anymore. But if you can listen to it and really pay attention to it, and again, you don't have to be a fan, and you can say, okay, you know what, this music is not important, and it's not creative, and it's not ingenious, then I think you're not listening with pure heart, pure soul, pure ears, pure mind, and pure intention.
That's the voice of Sophia Chang, the author of a new book, The Baddest Bee in the Room. Let's talk a little bit about the book. It's an audio book, and you do something, I don't know how unique it is, because I don't often listen to audio books. You know, I listen to a few, but the ones that I have, it's just been pretty straightforward. But here, you know, I'm hearing Method Man's voice, I'm hearing your voice, and you have sound effects in it, so it's like, you know, walking through a movie without necessarily seeing the picture on the screen. And, you know, to me, that's very hip-hop in a way. But let's talk about this, because you cover a whole lot. You know, it's not just about what you did with Wu-Tang and others, but it's also talking about your upbringing and the challenges that you had as a you know, young woman trying to find your way in this world. You know, starting with the fact that you talk, you know, very detailed about growing up and wanting to be white and what that whole experience is like. So let's deal with the concept of the book, why you went in the direction that you did, and some of the highlights people should pay attention to.
Okay. So thank you for likening it to a movie with no picture. That's exactly what I set out to do, David. I said, I want, when people listen to my audiobook, I want them to feel like they are listening to a movie. So I have achieved what my audiobook, what nobody else has achieved. You have the author's voice. You have 25 guest voices, cameos of the characters reading their own lines. Sound design, original score, music licenses, and the music was scratched in by DJ Scratch, the greatest turntablist of all time. I have also, for the first time in Audible's history, created both an explicit and a clean version, because I come from hip hop and I remember those days and I remember the parental advisory sticker. So no one's ever done what I've done before. And I'll take my Grammy now. Thank you very much. And let me tell you something. Let me tell you something, Davey. If I don't get a Grammy, I will bum rush that stage like ODB, God rest his soul, and I will snatch it out of whoever's hands it is in, and I'll yell, "My name is Sophia Chang, I'm the baddest bee in the room, and Wu-Tang is for the children."
It would be funny if you did that. It would be funny if you did that to Taylor Swift and revisit that, just for the irony of it.
Exactly, and I'm glad that I'm not competing with Michelle Obama, because I would never do that to her. So I would say that. So essentially, the process was that I was shopping the book deal the traditional route, but a very good, close, smart friend of mine ran digital at Hello Sunshine. And when I told her about the book, she said, I think we might want to do this as an audiobook. And my very first call with my editor at Audible, she said, we want to create a bespoke audio book for you. And the first thing out of my mouth, Davey, was, can I have Method Man in my audiobook? And she said, if you can get him, you can have him. Because I knew, regardless of medium, that the anecdote that would open my story was the studio with Meth, the Where Are You From story.
Yeah.
Because it was so significant, not to my career, but to my personal development, to understanding what it meant to be family in a way that we hadn't talked about when I was growing up. So being able to aggregate all of my resources and talents and experiences, you know, I've managed composers, right? I've worked on films. I understand what sound design is. I have cleared samples. I have cleared music. Like, I understand every aspect of that. And I think because of my singular experience and all of the jobs that I've had and all of the challenges that I've undertaken in music, I knew that I could do something that nobody had done before. Now, in terms of how it all played out, it was very, very difficult. And I will say, I never want to chase another rapper for the rest of my life. But so, it was also incredibly rewarding. And so, please, everybody, stop sending me your YouTube links and your SoundCloud.
So I can imagine. So, you know, you have to chase somebody down to read excerpts from the book and do all that sort of stuff. Did you have to get clearances to have Method's voice in there and to have...
Oh, of course. Yeah. So I'm doing two things. I'm getting their voices and I'm getting clearances signed. Absolutely. And there were probably 9 straight days I cried every day at some point because it was incredibly stressful because I did everything by myself. I got all of the voices by myself. I got all of the clearances by myself. And, you know, to be fair, there was nobody else that could do it. Method Man is not going to let anybody else sit in his hotel room in Norfolk, Virginia, 1 o'clock in the morning. While he's packing his bags, right? Who am I going to send to do that?
But let me ask you this before you move on, though. You're basically telling a story, and it's a great story. And one would wonder, like, is that a fair thing to have happen? That you have to get clearances to have the voices of people who you're telling these stories about to come on to your thing? That seems like, you know, as you said, it's a folk story, and in traditional folk stories, you know, we always have that, or, you know, people that come around and they add to it. Like, if we're in a barbershop and we're telling the story, somebody will jump in and somebody else will jump in, and collectively we tell this story. But it seems like the process of the music industry or the entertainment world makes it hard to do something that I think would be very natural in so many of our cultures. Would you agree, or am I missing a point there?
No, I absolutely agree that, I mean, I feel like at the point that they read their lines, isn't permission implied, right? But again, I ran A&R administration and operations for Universal Music Group, for the East Coast Group. And I was the first person that cleared samples at Jive back in 91. I am very, very clear on what clearances are necessary legally, and even though I don't necessarily think that we need them, I understand why the industry has to be hyper careful about it. Yeah, I do think it's completely organic and it's completely natural. I mean, Meth sat there with me, and Redman sat there with me, and RZA and Jizza, you know, they're all giving me their lines. Why would we need them to sign off on a clearance? That doesn't make any sense, because clearly, they know their intention is clear on giving it to me. That said, you know, from a corporate perspective, and Audible is a corporation, Universal Music Group is a corporation, their viewpoint is, we understand, Sophia, but we are exploiting their voice. And it, God forbid anything ever happens, which it never would, but again, from their perspective, and they turn around and say, hey, we never gave you permission to do this. I mean, it's kind of like when you do an interview at MTV or VH1 or BET and they make you sign a release. Wait a minute, I'm in the studio. I'm on the camera. I'm talking on the microphone. Obviously, you have my permission, but everybody has to get that. Everybody needs that piece of paper. And it's a drag, and it is a pain in the behind. But you got to do it. But I agree with you. It would be so great if we could just let the process be more organic. But we, you know, the organic ship sailed a long time ago.
Wow. Who, you know, let's go over a few things with you. Sophia Chang on the line with us this afternoon, Hard Knock Radio, talking about her new book, The Baddest Bee in the Room. For people just to get a deeper appreciation, let's start off with some of the things that you did. You started off with working with Paul Simon. We know you from Wu-Tang, but you also mentioned being in movies and all that. So can you give us a brief, you know, rundown of some of the things you did? And I'm asking this because, as I started off in saying, you're a powerful person in the industry that is often not included in these conversations about people who have had impact. And then in certain circles, you know, you're like revered, you know, especially in the Asian community with people that are coming up. You know, yours and Jeff Chang's are two names that immediately people reference and say, I want to be like them when I grow up. So let's kind of, you know, run down a little bit of your resume for people who don't know.
Okay, thank you for asking. Born and raised in Vancouver, proud child of Korean immigrants. French lit major that was definitely supposed to go on into academia. Then I heard the message by Grandmaster Flash in The Furious Five, and that turned my head around. I moved to New York. My first industry job, as you mentioned, was with Paul Simon, coming off the Graceland tour. My next job was doing as an assistant, then moving on to marketing in the newly formed alternative department at Atlantic. That was around 1991. I got hired to do A&R Jive, which is being the talent scout. And then I left Jive to start a marketing company with a colleague. And then my first job as a manager was to manage Old Dirty Bastard. He was the first person to ever say, I want you to manage me. And then in 1995, I met Shriyan Ming, a 34th generation Shaolin monk. And I took a hard ride out of the music business, and I started training 15 hours a week, managing him, managing his temple. We fell in love, had two children. I maintained a number of my relationships in hip-hop, but was out of the business. And then when probably around 2007 or so, I got back into the music business. In the mid-2000s, I managed what I call RZA's extracurricular activities, which was his anything in film and television, not as an MC nor a hip-hop producer, but anything in film and television, whether that was acting or scoring. It was mainly scoring at that time, or screenwriting. And I, 2007 and 8, I managed Rafael Sadiq for his, what I consider is his magnum opus, The Way I See It. That was his homage to Motown. And then I managed GZA, and I managed Organized Noise Productions, who are the Atlanta producing trio who, to me, were largely responsible for creating the sound of the Dirty South. They had Outkast. They did the whole first Outkast album, the whole first Goody Mob album. Rico Wade was the person that put TLC together. And they got a Grammy for Waterfall, which I think is an amazing record. I also managed GZA in 2014, and then I went on to run, as I mentioned, A&R Administration and Operations at Universal Music Group in 2014. I ran Cinematic Music Group, which was a home to Joey Badass, Pro Era, G Herbo, Mick Jenkins. And then I ran Pro Era Records, which is Joey's label. And then in October 2017, Joey said, Sophia, go write your book. And I am eternally grateful to him, because if Joey had asked me to stay, I would have stayed. I would do anything for Joey Badass. And I left. And in April 2018, I got a deal, and I wrote the hell out of my memoir. So that's my history in a nutshell.
It's an impressive one, and you managed to navigate. For people that are coming up in the industry, what would you say, or two or three pieces of advice that you would give to them to really be successful in that navigation?
Davey, do you mean on the artist side or the executive side?
You know, I didn't think of it that way. I'm thinking of it as one and the same. But let's go on the executive side. If you're getting into this rough and tumble business on the executive side, what would be two or three things you would say?
Be good at your job. And that sounds really banal, Davey. But people are really excited about being in the music business because it's you're celebrity adjacent and you get to go to shows and clubs and the VIP section and all that. And I understand that, but that is the gravy. That is not the meat. It is the icing. It is not the cake. The meat of the job is whatever the hell your job is. If you are the receptionist, be a great receptionist. If you are an assistant, take the messages, get everything done when you're supposed to, follow up when you need to. If you are a promotion person, make sure that you call every station that you're supposed to. Get the core of your job done, and then anything that you want to do beyond that, ask permission. But if you're so good at the foundation of your job, your boss, if he or she is a good person, will encourage you to learn more. The second thing that I would highly recommend is learning how to read contracts. Because few are the people that get into the industry who don't want to get to the level where you are going to require a contract. If you work at a record company, by the time you reach, probably VP, senior VP, maybe even before that, you will be handed an employment agreement. Now, you should absolutely have an attorney review that and go through it with you. But if you can learn how to read it, it will be good for you. As you start to climb in the industry, whether you're a manager, whether you're an executive, legal papers will cross your desk. And I think it's really important for people to learn how to read a contract.
And even more important, it's important that they actually read the contract, because a lot of people just like, here's a standard contract, and they'd be like, okay, and they sign it and don't realize, you know, that they sign rights away and all kind of stuff.
Exactly. And even if you have an attorney, and I'm not saying it is fun, it is so boring. It is so dry. The legalese is so dense. But even if you have an attorney review it, and you should at least have an attorney walk you through it. This clause, this stipulation, this is really standard language, Sophia, force majeure, act of God, representations and warranties, indemnities, all of there are certain things that you will see that will come up in every single contract, right? Term, territory, all of that kind of stuff. And the more fluent you get in it, the more you are empowered. The last thing is to learn how to negotiate. So there are jobs where this is not going to be necessary. But again, as you rise in the ranks, you will find yourself in a position where you have to negotiate more and more and more, whether it's on your behalf or on behalf of other people. And I say this specifically to the people out there that want to be managers, whether you want to manage a producer, an artist, a studio, whatever it is. You don't have to do that so much. Like if you're doing, actually, a lot of it is a negotiation. I was going to say if you're doing video production, but if you are the video commissioner at a label, you are absolutely negotiating with the director of the video, the producer of the video, with the vendors. So learn how to negotiate. I think that women are less trained to negotiate. I think we are less fluent in that language, and so I always encourage my mentees, who are all women, to learn how to negotiate. And then in terms of what I would say to artists, learn the business. Go get Don Passman's Everything You Need to Know About the Music Business and read that book. He writes in a pretty vernacular tone. It is very readable. It can tell you more than, you know, in those, whatever it is, 330 pages than I could ever tell you. There's more in there than I've ever learned myself. And so when people say, I don't know this, I don't know that, I don't have any resources, yes, you do, because I think Don's book is pretty damn comprehensive. So there are no excuses. And if not Don Passman's book, then Google it. We have a world of knowledge, more than we could ever want or need at our fingertips. Educate yourself. Do not make the mistakes that people made before you, because nobody has the excuse of ignorance anymore. You don't. It's right there. You can learn everything right there. That is really, really, really important. Also, in looking for a label or a manager, what I would say to the artists out there is find somebody who is truly, truly passionate. Someone who has your best interest at heart. This is the thing that I can say unequivocally, Davey. If you talk to any of my former clients, they will all say, oh, and I need to mention Blackalicious too, whom I managed briefly, whom I adore. They would all say that I always acted with their best interest at heart. I think that these days, particularly in the age of social media, where everybody wants to be a star and everybody wants to be internet famous, you now have managers that are also kind of angling to be celebrities themselves. Now, I don't care about that. But again, that's not the meat, it's the gravy. Get your job done. Do what you have to do. You are in the service industry. You are here to serve your client. That means subjugating all of your needs and all of your desires to that of your client. I'm not saying that you should get walked all over. I'm not saying that somebody should be able to drive a bus over you, take advantage of you, or not pay you. But your primary function is to take care of your artist in whatever way that means. If she needs to renegotiate a deal, if she needs to make sure that the towels are all clean before her show, if she needs to be walked through an interview, if she needs to have you backstage, making sure that she's ready to get on stage, if she needs you to take her to the record company and rain hellfire on the promo team, whatever it is, you do all of that. I do not care if it makes you uncomfortable. If it makes you uncomfortable to advocate on behalf of your client, to fight on behalf of your client, then you're in the wrong goddamn business. Because this is what you do. And go out there and get the opportunities. Don't sit there and just take incoming calls. If that's what you are, then artists might as well just hire a personal assistant and take the incoming calls. Go out there and hustle for your artist. Go bring him or her opportunities that he or she would not have thought about on their own.
Man, that's a lot of gems there. What would you say about the concept of ownership? You know, more and more people are looking, and we've seen in the past, because people didn't have a stake in some of their creation, they wound up, you know, not, you know, either being broke or definitely behind the eight ball. In terms of this negotiating and all this, if you create something, how important would that be? And let me just add this caveat to it. Much of what you're talking about just doesn't apply to the music industry. I mean, if you're in tech, if you're in academia, if you're in a lot of places, they have you have these contracts. And what is central to it, from my experience, is that there are these things like, hey, you know, if you work for our company and you come up with a good idea, it's our idea. We own it. You know, those sorts of things. And if you're not careful, you may come up with the next, you know, better mousetrap that, you know, the particular company then will say, we own it, and you don't have a stake. So how important would you say it is to own your intellectual property and your physical creations, or at least have a stake in it in 2019?
I mean, I think it's important and it would be amazing, but I've never seen an employment contract that doesn't have that. Everything that you come up with, any idea that you come up with, anything that you devise, when you work, within the time that you work for us, we own fully. I don't know of anybody that's ever gotten around that. I know that I haven't. I've tried, but that's, you know, I think in the corporations, in the company's mind, they're saying we are providing this fertile ground, and if you have an idea herein. Now, that said, I'm sure that there's, you know, it should also only pertain to whatever industry that is. So if I'm working at a record company and I come up with the next great idea for women's seamless underwear, they should not participate in that, right? And in terms of ownership in general, I think that artists, if they are in a financial position to do so, they should own their publishing. I think a lot of artists back in the day didn't really understand that there is a difference between the masters and the publishing. And the publishing is something that you can either do as a co-pub or you could do as an admin deal, and there are different percentages that people take. but publishing will continue to feed you, especially if you have a record that is going to be covered, right? If it's going to be licensed, I really recommend to my artists that they try to hold on to their publishing. I mean, this is to make it simple. I would rather that you own a two-bedroom apartment than rent a six-bedroom mansion.
And I think that is the thing that we've often heard. E-40 has said something similar. Paris has said something similar. Yeah, E-40, definitely. He's come on this show and has talked emphatically about, you know, don't buy a $25,000 car before you buy a house type of thing, and has laid it out pretty similar to what you said, that is your real estate. That's the thing. That's that wealth that can, you know, morph into generational wealth. And that's why we got to read and be up on this and understand the intricacies of the business.
Yeah, I mean, I believe a car, literally the second you drive it off the lot, the second it gets off the lot, I think it devalues 50%. A house, if you're smart about it, number one, you live in a house. Number two, that can be an investment. That is an asset for your children. That's how I look at it. I look at it as legacy building. I look at it as what am I going to leave my children? So you want to go buy a Dior bag? You want to go buy an Hermes bag or whatever? And they cost, I don't even know how much this stuff costs because I don't buy this stuff. You know, with little exception, unless they become vintage collectibles, you hold on to them for 30 years or whatever, those things too lose value. Now, I'm not saying don't get that stuff. That stuff is lovely. I'll spend $750 on a pair of shoes that I like. I'm not saying don't enjoy those things. But don't put those things before the assets, before the house. Own a home. So every meal that you go out for, if you could actually save that $30, $40, $50, and that buys you a week of groceries, and you could put that aside towards a down payment, do it. If you could not get the latest pair of whatever sneakers, I don't know what those are either. Maybe you really don't need those. If you could not get the rims or the car or the whatever it is, and I don't mean total abstinence. I don't mean live like a monk. But I'm saying if you could mediate, like if you could rather moderate your consumerism on things, your consumption of things that will not appreciate in value, that are not actual assets, then that will be really beneficial, and put that money towards buying a home. I think being a homeowner is one of the most important things that we can be for our own stability, our financial stability and comfort, and again, for what we pass on to our children.
We've been listening to the voice of Sophia Chang. The name of the book is The Baddest Bee in the Room, talking about her tenure, her successful tenure in the music industry, where she's had major, major impact. Sophia, we appreciate you spending time with us here on Hard Knock Radio. Where can people get the book, and are you doing a book tour and anything like that? And, you know, they also say that you're somebody whose lunch money we shouldn't try to take because of your martial artist prowess. So are you still training and doing all that sort of stuff?
I do Kung Fu, Shaolin Kung Fu, 6 days a week. I just came from the gym. I kick and punch every day except for Sundays, baby. Yes, I do.
So in other words, don't take your money. Don't try to take your money, huh?
Yeah, it means that Wu-Tang Chang ain't nothing to mess with. Absolutely. Where can you buy my audiobook? My memoir is available exclusively on audible.com, and it will, I promise you, you've never heard anything like it. My memoir is for anyone who has ever felt marginalized, undervalued, underseen, underheard, anybody who ever had the audacity to say yes when society, their parents, the dominant culture told them no. For anybody who has ever wanted to or has claimed their worth when the world has told them that they're not worth that much. For anybody who has ever dared to tell their story. Because I've thought about this a lot lately, Davey. Thought about erasure and invisibility. And I thought about how those of us who live on the margins are systematically and institutionally erased daily and assiduously and efficiently. And that it is incumbent upon all of us to tell our stories. Because by telling our stories, this is how we build community. This is how we engender empathy. And if we have empathy for somebody, we will see them as human. And when you see somebody as human, you are far less likely to commit the atrocities that we see out, that we see play out daily in this country and in this world. And this is the line, these are the three words that I heard from Quest Green, who presided over Fife Dog, God rest his soul, Fife Dog of a Tribe Called Quest celebration at the Apollo. He kept saying, tell your story. Tell your story. So that those are my parting words to your listeners. Please get out there, and whatever form it takes, whether you're a sculptor, whether you're an author, whether you're an MC or a producer or a dancer or a litigator and whoever you represent, tell your story.
Powerful words to end on. Sophia Chang, thank you so much for joining us. Hard Knock Radio, the name of the book, the audio book, and it's a book indeed. It's cinema without the picture. It is the baddest bee in the room, and we appreciate the gems that you dropped with us this afternoon. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
The New York Times side, staying alive was no job at second hands. Moms bounced on old men, so then we moved to Shaolin land. A young youth, you're rocking the gold tooth, low goose. Only way I begin to G-York was drug loot. And let's start it like this, son, rolling with this one and that one, pulling out gats for fun. But it was just a dream for the team who was a fiend. Started smoking wools at 16 and running up in gates and doing hits for high stakes, making my way on fire skates. No question I was speed for cracks and weed. The combination made my eyes bleed. No question I would flow off and try to get the dough off. Sticking up right boys on board. My life got no better. Same damn low sweater. Times is rough and tough like leather. Figured out I went the wrong route. So I got with a sick tight click and went all out. Catching keys from cross seas. Rolling in MPVs every week. We made 40 G's. Yo, brothers, respect mine. I ain't gonna tech now. Bam! Move from the gate now.
Cash rules everything around me, cream, get the money, dollar, dollar bill, yo. Cash rules everything around me, cream, get the money, dollar, dollar bill, yo.
It's been 22 long, hard years, I'm still struggling. Survival got me bugging, but I'm alive on arrival. I peep at the shape of the streets to stay awake to the ways of the world deep. A man with a dream, with plans to make cream, was fail. I went to jail at the age of 15, a young buck selling drugs and such, who never had much, trying to get a clutch on what I could not touch. The court played me so now I face incarceration, pacing, no one upstates my destination. Handcuffed in back of a bus, 40 of us. Life as a shorty shouldn't be so rough, but as the world turned, I learned life was hell. Living in the world no different from a cell. Every day I skate from takes, giving chase, selling bass, smoking bones in the staircase. Though I don't know why I chose to smoke cess, I guess that's the time when I'm not depressed. But I'm still depressed, and I ask, what's it worth? Ready to give up, so I seek the old earth. Who explain working hard may help you maintain, to learn to overcome the heartaches and pain. You got stick up kids, corrupt cops, and crack rocks and stray shots. All in a block that stays hot. Leave it up to me while I be living proof, to kick the truth to the young black youth.
And shorties running wild, smoking cess, drinking beer. And ain't trying to hear what I'm kicking in his ear. Neglected for now, but yo, it got to be accepted. That what? The life is hectic.
Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo. Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo. Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo. Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo. Dollar, dollar bill, yo. Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo.
And as we close out today's edition of Hard Knock Radio, we'd like to let you know about the Love Life Foundation's second annual Oakland's Finest Black Tie Holiday Ball and Toy Drive. An elegant gala honoring our finest community leaders, politicians, entertainers, athletes, and inspiring youth. Presented by Donald Lacey Jr. and the Love Life Foundation, this Saturday, November 30th, 5 to 11 p.m. at Scott Seafood Restaurant in Oakland. More information at www.lovelifefoundation.org.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 10 o'clock a.m. And coming up next, we have a collaboration from the various stations that make up the entity known as Oregon Community Media. We'll just jump right in.
Welcome to the collaborative show between stations that participate in Oregon Community Media. Oregon Community Media is an association of non-commercial radio stations working together to strengthen local independent media to better serve diverse communities. This time you'll hear about how legalized cannabis has played out around the state in Ashland, Bend, and Warm Springs. Participating this time are KSKQ in Ashland, KPOV in Bend, and KWSO Warm Springs. I'm Erin Yankee from KBOO, collator and host for this episode. Stay tuned. In 2000,